Welcome to Parents' Perspective. No, 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 wailed 9-year-old Mitch. I said I don't want to go and I won't go. He threw his towel and goggles across the floor. But you like your swim lessons, his mom gingerly picked up the thrown items. Last time we went, you didn't want to come home. Well, I'm not going, and you can't make me. Mitch's voice grew louder, and he crossed his arms over his chest defiantly. Look, Mitch, 5-year-old Chad came trotting into the hall, proudly clutching his new pair of water wings. He smiled up at his brother. Now I can swim, too. We're not going to stupid swimming, stupid, Mitch growled, so put away that dumb stuff. And with a swipe of his hand, he knocked the water wings to the floor. Chad began to cry as he retrieved his water wings, and Mitch's dad strode into the hall as if on cue. All right, he bellowed. That's absolutely enough of this nonsense. He grabbed Mitch by the arm. You are going to sit right over here in this corner until you learn to be civil to the members of your family. Now sit. Instead of sitting, Mitch began to flail his arms and legs against the walls and woodwork, making dents with his shoes. His screams echoed from the hallway through the other rooms. Mitch's mom looked at his father with desperation. How is this kid ever going to learn to behave? From a parent's perspective, how can we help meltdown kids? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today is an expert in such difficult behaviors. Dr. Ross W. Green is an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, on the professional staff in the Department of Psychology at the Cambridge Health Alliance, adjunct associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Virginia Tech, and senior lecturer in the School Psychology Program in the Department of Education at Tufts University. He is the originator of a model of psychosocial treatment for challenging kids called collaborative problem solving, or CPS, as described in his books The Explosive Child and Lost at School. Dr. Green is also the founder of a nonprofit organization, Lives in the Balance, which aims to provide advocacy and support for behaviorally challenging kids and their parents, teachers, and other caregivers, and to disseminate the CPS model through no-cost web-based programming. Dr. Green consults extensively to general and special education schools, inpatient and residential facilities, and systems of juvenile detention, and lectures widely throughout the world. Dr. Green is the father of a 10-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Green.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's the biggest misconception we adults have about children's misbehavior?
The biggest misconception we adults have about children's misbehavior is why they are misbehaving in the first place. We characterize kids who are frequently misbehaving as attention-seeking, manipulative, coercive, unmotivated, limit-testing. We characterize their parents as passive, permissive, inconsistent, non-contingent. I think we got both of those parts wrong. So I think that the biggest problem out there is that we have the wrong lenses on when it comes to kids who misbehave. And those inaccurate lenses often lead us to interventions that are very counterproductive.
You've written a book on what you call the explosive child. Can you describe such youngsters?
Well, the first thing I should say is I wish I hadn't called it the explosive child. Because it doesn't just refer to those who explode, it refers to those who implode as well. It refers to any kid who's doing anything we don't like in response to the demands that we are placing upon them. So that can mean any variety of different things. At the mild end, it can mean whining, pouting, sulking, crying, getting a little worse here, screaming, swearing, a little worse still, biting, spitting, kicking, hitting, throwing, destroying, running, lying, stealing. I simply refer to these behaviors as looking bad. And when do kids look bad? When they're having trouble looking good. And when do they have trouble looking good? When the demands that we are placing upon them outstrip the skills that they have to respond adaptively to those demands. So this isn't attention-seeking or manipulative or coercive or unmotivated or limit testing. This isn't passive, permissive, inconsistent, non-contingent parenting. Why are challenging kids challenging? Because they are lacking the skills not to be challenging. What skills do challenging kids lack? Skills like, and these are the umbrella skills, flexibility, adaptability, frustration tolerance, and problem solving. How do we know this? Because challenging kids only look bad in conditions in which those skills are being demanded.
That's interesting. So are they born with this lack of skill sets? Does it make them different from other kids in that way?
Well, I think that there are parents of kids who have difficult temperaments who will tell you that something was amiss from the word go. These are infants who are having difficulty self-soothing, reacting badly to changes, reacting badly to sensory stimuli. These are infants who are having difficulty meeting the demands that we are placing upon them from the word go. But other kids don't start exhibiting challenging behaviors until, oh, say, 2 or 3 years old. What happens at 2 or 3? We expect kids to communicate through words increasingly at 2 or 3, to communicate their needs, to communicate their concerns, to communicate what's the matter. All will go well if these skills develop along with those demands. But if those skills don't develop, then you have another point in development where things could start not looking so good. At some point in development, we expect kids to sit still, pay attention, control their impulses. All will go well with those demands if a kid has the skills to meet those demands. But we know that that's also when kids who are impulsive, overactive, and having difficulty paying attention will fall off the apple cart. So kids look bad, kids misbehave, when the demands being placed upon them exceed the skills that they have to respond adaptively to those demands.
So what's the difference between a youngster with these kinds of difficult behaviors or problems and what we might just refer to as an ornery kid, a child who seems to get stuck in negative interactions?
I would have difficulty telling the difference. See, here's the interesting thing. We often distinguish these kids based on what they look like when they're looking bad. And sometimes, if they look bad enough, they will meet criteria for a psychiatric diagnosis, which also tells us what they look like when they're looking bad. I'm not one to distinguish in a big way between kids based on what they look like when they're not looking good. The exact same lagging skills that give rise to pitching a fit or refusing to do what one is told are the exact same lagging skills that can set the stage for a child to be anxious, worried, exact same lagging skills. And so what's clear to me is that the lagging skills are the important part, not what the kid looks like because he's lacking those skills.
Is maturity a part of this in any way? Like preschool kids have to learn to sit in a circle for circle time.
Indeed.
And some children, of course, are up walking around during circle time. Is that going to change as they get older, or are those same kids going to continue to have that kind of problem?
The demands increase. Mm-hmm. If a kid at 3 or 4 is lacking the skills to meet the demands of age 3 or 4, and we don't do anything about that, I don't have any anticipation that maturity will fix it. Okay. I have anticipation that we're going to have to teach some skills, and that's what's going to fix it. I'm betting he's going to be having trouble at 7 and 8, too, 11 and 12, too, 16 and 17, too, if we don't intervene in ways that make sense.
We intervening means people like you, not just the parents.
Well, I'm happy to help. But quite frankly, it's the people who are with the kid who are the ones who are going to be intervening with him because they're the ones who are in the mix. See, it takes two to tango. Yes, one of the things we know about challenging kids is that they're lacking important skills. But if it's also true that they only look challenging when those skills are being demanded, then we also have to take a look at the people who are demanding those skills and how they are going about demanding them and how they are dealing with things when the child is having difficulty meeting those demands. So, yes, challenging kids lack crucial thinking skills. How we handle them and what demands we place upon them is the dance partner of the two that it takes to tango.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of Meltdown Kids.
The popular book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Ross Green about dealing with meltdown kids. But it's interesting because I was thinking of culturally and historically, demands have changed. I was thinking of the schoolhouses in the 1800s and early 1900s where everybody, no matter how old you were, we were supposed to sit and pay attention and be quiet. And I was thinking of my experiences a million years ago when I was a teacher of eighth graders. And one class I had was kids, all of whom had failed at least once. And it wasn't necessarily the academic part, it was the paying attention part. They were growing, their muscles were uncomfortable, they were not comfortable sitting in chairs for a huge amount of time. It was very interesting because I just let them sit on tabletops or on shelves or something like that, and they paid attention.
Good for you. There, I'm sure you know, are colleagues of yours who would not have been so accommodating.
So the question here is, how do we know when we're making appropriate demands, since the demands themselves have changed over the years?
Well, this is the interesting thing. There's the school curriculum, and there's high-stakes testing, and that's what tells us what bar a student needs to get over by a certain point in time. Students who are making progress toward getting over that bar are letting us know that in fairly explicit ways. They are making progress. They're not having difficulty dealing with the demands that we are placing upon them. But I think it is just as obvious when students are struggling to meet the demands that we are placing upon them. And that's when the lenses we are wearing kicks in. Here's a very common mistake I find that we make. We place a demand on a kid, and we often say, I know he has the skills to handle that demand. The problem is, he's not doing it. Rather than questioning our assumption that he has the skills to do it, we don't look back. Instead, we assume he has the skills, he's not doing what we're asking him to do, and we jump to the immediate conclusion, he must not be motivated to do what we're asking him to do. And then what do? We kick in with the motivational strategies. When I'm dealing with a kid who's not doing well, and the first thing out of people's mouths is, I know he has the skills to do well, first thing that pops into my head, given that I now know he's not doing well, is, I doubt it. Because if he had the skills to be doing well, he'd be doing well. Because doing well is preferable. Why on earth, if he had the skills to do well, would he not be doing well? Why on earth would we come to the conclusion that the reason he's not doing well is because he's manipulative, attention-seeking, coercive, unmotivated, limit-testing? Isn't the logical conclusion, given that doing well is preferable, that if he had the skills to be doing well, he would be doing well, and if he's not doing well, it must be because he's lacking the skills?
What factors have you found that contribute to this kind of child's tendency to melt down? Are there certain things, red flags, that should go up when we see things happening?
Well, red flags go up when we see a child exhibiting behaviors that we wish he wouldn't exhibit. So there's your usual first red flag. Now it depends what lenses you're wearing, right? My approach to this is, the minute I see behaviors that we wish a child wasn't exhibiting, my immediate first assumption is not that he's been poorly disciplined. I've worked with way too many parents of ill-behaved children who also had well-behaved children in their homes. This is not about poor discipline. This is about lagging skills. Those being the lenses that I'm wearing, if I'm hearing about or observing a child exhibiting behaviors that we wish he wouldn't exhibit, safe in the assumption that doing well is preferable and that he'd prefer to be doing well, where do I stop first? First, I start on, what skills is this child lacking? And I've got a list of skills frequently found lacking in challenging kids. Goal number one, figure out what skills this child is lacking so that we have the right lenses on. Goal number two, and this is where your story comes in. under what specific conditions, I call them unsolved problems. Other people call them antecedents. Some people call them triggers, conditions. Under what specific conditions is a child exhibiting challenging behaviors? In the case of the story that you just told, it's, I don't want to go to the swimming lesson. Going to the swimming lesson is an unsolved problem. I'm betting that that child has a list of about 8, 9, 10 unsolved problems. Problems waiting to be solved. Reliably and predictably setting in motion challenging episodes. Goal number one, make sure that the adults who are with him have the right lenses on. Why are challenging kids challenging? Because they're lacking the skills not to be challenging. Let's figure out what skills he's lacking. Goal number two, identify in very specific terms what unsolved problems are reliably and predictably setting in motion challenging episodes in this particular child. We now have one on the list for the child who you started the program with. Goal number three, move those problems from the unsolved pile, where they are setting in motion challenging episodes, to the solved pile. Solved problems don't set in motion challenging episodes. Only unsolved problems do. In other words, we adults, as it relates to challenging kids, we're in the problem-solving business, not the motivation business. Huge difference. Tracing totally back to what lenses we have on.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of meltdown kids. Parents' perspective needs you, your feedback, your opinions, and not least, your donations that help with the cost of producing this award-winning program.
Visit us online at www.parentsperspective.org and click on to Give Direct, I Give, or eBay at Mission Fish. Please help us continue to help you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Ross Green about dealing with meltdown kids. So how can parents do that? How do you stop the cycle of explosions going on in your home?
You do the first two things that I just said. First, you get the right lenses on. Then you identify in very specific terms the unsolved problems that are reliably and predictably setting in motion these challenging episodes. And then you decide how you want to solve problems. As I described in both The Explosive Child and Lost at School, you have three options: Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. Plan A is when you are solving those problems unilaterally, usually through imposition of adult will, usually with adult-imposed consequences attached. What's the problem with that? Plan A sets in motion challenging behavior in challenging kids. This is very reliable. Rewind the tape on the vast majority of challenging episodes and challenging kids, and what will you find? An adult using Plan A. Interesting. Who gets more Plan A thrown at them than any other type of kid? The challenging ones, which of course makes no sense whatsoever if you already know why challenging kids are challenging. Plan A will continue to make perfect sense if you don't know why challenging kids are challenging. Plan B is when you're solving problems collaboratively. That's what I spend most of my waking moments teaching adults how to do. Plan C is when you're dropping some unsolved problems, at least for now. Not as an act of caving. That's not what the C stands for. Not as an act of capitulating. That's not what the C stands for. But as an act of prioritizing. One of the reasons unsolved problems of challenging kids remain unsolved is because adults try to work on them all at once. And we're going to have to prioritize if we're going to get them solved, which means we're working on two or three of them at a time, and the rest we're tabling for now. And what that does is it clears some space off the hard drive so that we have the energy and the headspace to actually start solving the ones that we've decided we're going to work on. So I want to point out something very important. By identifying unsolved problems, we are making the whole process of problem solving proactive. any unsolved problem we are identifying is by definition predictable. Plan B isn't intended to be implemented emergently in the heat of the moment. It's bad timing for any intervention. Whenever somebody says to me, what should I do in the heat of the moment? I don't have great advice for them. There's nothing great to do in the heat of the moment except chill people out and keep people safe. Collaborative problem solving occurs proactively, made possible by the fact that the vast majority of unsolved problems setting in motion challenging episodes are highly predictable, but only if we take the time to figure out what the unsolved problems are in the first place.
And so now, drumroll, it's time to discuss Plan B.
Plan B is three steps, but really three ingredients. I've always referred to the steps as the empathy step, the define the problem step, and the invitation step. But they are really three ingredients. And this is how you solve a problem collaboratively. Ingredient number one, the empathy step, is where we are gathering information from the child so as to understand his concern or perspective on the unsolved problem we're talking with him about right now.
Which means you bring up the unsolved problem at a quiet time.
Correct.
I notice that you seem not to like going to your swimming lesson.
You got it. If you have the right lenses on and you're being proactive, that's the easy part of the empathy step. The hard part of the empathy step is often in response to what's up, kids, if they say something, whatever they say doesn't give us the clearest possible sense of their concern or perspective. So we have to probe for more information, a process that I call drilling for information. And that is very hard for many adults. The goal is to be as clear as possible about the kid's concern or perspective on a given unsolved problem. Now, other things can happen when we say what's up as well. The one that gives the adults the hardest time is, I don't know, or silence. Right? Now, if a kid says, I don't know, or goes silent on us in response to what's up, there's an excellent chance that that has more to do with us than it does with them. We may not have been being proactive. You greatly increase the likelihood of I don't know or silence if you are trying to do this collaborative problem solving in the heat of the moment, emergently. We may not have been specific enough about our concern. The goal is to be as specific as possible so that the kid knows what we're actually talking about. So here's not specific. I've noticed you get mad sometimes. What's up? He has no idea what we're talking about. We have just greatly increased the likelihood of I don't know or silence. I've noticed that sometimes you don't want to go to your swimming lesson. What's up? Much more specific. A much more specific unsolved problem. We've just reduced the likelihood by being specific of him not going silence on us and him not saying, I don't know. The other key ingredient is neutrality. In other words, we're not saying, so you don't want to go to your swimming lesson because you don't mind drowning? You don't want to go to your swimming lesson because you enjoy giving us a hard time? You can't just do stuff when you feel like it in the real world. If you're not neutral, he's not going to talk to you. If he's not talking to you, you're not going to gather information. You're not going to know what his concern or perspective is, and this unsolved problem will remain unsolved. Second step, the define the problem step. This is where the adult is getting their concern or perspective entered into consideration on the same unsolved problem that we're talking with the child about proactively right now. Adults have legitimate concerns as well. By the way, I've never met a kid's concern that wasn't legitimate. The problem, of course, is that kids are accustomed to having their concerns blown off the table by adult concerns. And I'm always asking myself, why would you want to do that? Why would we adults want to be in the business of blowing kids' concerns off the table? The answer is we wouldn't want to be in that business. Third ingredient, the invitation. The ingredient, though, is brainstorming. This is where adult and child, and by the way, this is not limited to adult-child interactions. This is child-child, adult-adult, are brainstorming solutions, but a highly specialized type of solution. Solutions that are going to address the concerns of both parties that we put so much energy into identifying in the first two ingredients of Plan B. Here's the other thing I'll say about Plan B. Many people hear it and they say, doesn't sound so hard. Actually, for most people, it is extremely hard. And the idea is to stick with it so as to get past the hard part.
So accept failures when you're doing it.
I tend to stay away from the word failure. I would say that early Plan B is unlikely to look very good. I always tell people your first two Plan Bs are your hardest because the first one's unlikely to go very well, and the second one's hard because the first one didn't go very well. That's not the time to throw in the towel. That's the time to go back to many of the resources that I've made available to people, either on the website or in the books. I'm very explicit about all of the things that can go wrong and how to fix them.
Are there any resources you would suggest to our listeners who want to pursue these issues further?
For parents, I would strongly recommend The Explosive Child, fourth edition. It's the most current rendition. Educators, I would recommend Lost at School. And for everybody, I would recommend the website of my nonprofit, Lives in the Balance, which is simply www.livesinthebalance.org.
Well, you have certainly given us a lot of resources just in this conversation. So, Dr. Ross Green, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of one of Dr. Green's books, The Explosive Child or Lost at School. When you call us, tell us whether you're an educator or a parent, and we'll send you the appropriate book. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 477 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. Or check us out at facebook.com/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Mark Vitelli. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt. Mm-hmm.